Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Plains on the Prairie podcast. I'm Max.
And I'm Sam.
And we have, I think, our probably most special episode of Plains on the Prairie in over 3 years, if not ever.
Yeah, this is fun.
Yeah,
It's been
this is going to be a really exciting one. So today we'll be talking about Captain William J. Hennen of the U.S. Army Air Force during World War II. But we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined with Mike Roddenbush, who is actually William Hennen's son. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Actually, my full name is Michael Hennen Rottenbusch.
Gotcha. Well, we're honored to have you, and thank you so much for coming on. We're just going to hop right into it. It's going to be like a standard episode of our Minnesota Aces series. But we'll obviously we have with Mike joining us, we'll be kind of filling in some of the gaps that we really haven't been able to fill in for a lot of our previous Minnesota Aces.
Exactly. And yeah, and this is going to be great because Mike, you'll be able to put in a lot of the personal ties where, normally I think we've talked in the past where we've only been able to get, the combat career. So this is a nice extra element to it.
Great.
Absolutely. All right, so we'll get started here. William J. Hennen, or Bill as he went by, was born on June 13th, 1919, in Minneapolis. And as a young man, he grew up in Mound, Minnesota, and attended Mound High School, where he graduated in 1937. Now, during his time at Mound, he was quite the athlete.
Yeah.
Reading his biography, he played both football and basketball and lettered in both. So, quite the
Yeah.
athlete, honestly. Following his high school career, he then attended the United, or excuse me, the University of Minnesota, and was part of their reserve officer training program there, where he studied aeronautical engineering. Mike, I know we asked you in our first phone call, but do you recall any stories about your father when he was a young man, both in high school and then during his time in college?
Yeah, he was an avid hunter, which he carried on when he was down in the Philippines. He hunted there and also in Australia. I'm just trying to think. He started dating my mother in college. He actually started out at the University of Minnesota Navy ROTC for a short period of time, but then he figured out that by joining the Army ROTC, he'd have a chance to be a air cadet and ultimately a fire for the Army. He was doing a lot of civilian flight training, as part of a program the Army had while he was at the university. And my grandfather told a story that he took Bill took him up in a plane when he was after he'd soloed, and my grandfather pointed down. He was an avid photographer. And my dad thought that he was wanted him to get a better view, so he opened the door to the plane, and my grandfather got some great shots. And that's that. Those are some of the things I remember.
Gotcha. And maybe this came on later in his military service, but you said since he was a hunter, this gets into more training. So we'll come back to this story in a sec. So then after he graduated from the University of Minnesota, he received his wings at Kelly Field in 1941 as part of Class 41B and was assigned to the 17th Pursuit Squadron of the 24th Pursuit Group based at Nichols Field in the Philippines. So this might be a good point to segue in here. Mike, you said earlier that he was an avid hunter, and you had mentioned a story to us on the phone that with his hunting skills, was he considered a pretty good shot?
Oh yeah, he sure was. In fact, he probably why he had so much success as a fighter pilot. He was an excellent shot, as was his grandpa, as it was his father, my grandfather. I never got to hunt with them because by that time we'd moved to with my grandfather because we'd moved to California. Also, just a quick side story, my uncle wanted to fly also in World War II. And when he mentioned to the powers that be that he was a pheasant hunter, they said, okay, you're going to be a tail gunner. That was the end of his piloting dreams. And he survived the war.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Mike. And then at the Phil or in the Philippines, Bill Hennen flew P-26s for initial combat training, so they were starting to get worn out, the P-26 pea shooters. Then they transferred to the Sikorsky P-35As, and then in 1941, Hennen started training in on the P-40s, not long after the Japanese attack on the Philippines on December 8th. So on October 13th, 1941, just a couple months before the war started, he was flying a P-35 from Iba Field in Luzon. And Hennen was involved in a mid-air collision when one member of his formation struck the rear of his aircraft, causing the aircraft to separate. Thankfully, he was able to bail out and open his parachute where he landed nearby. What I kind of found funny, and I'm sure you probably may have chuckled at this, Mike, is he seemed pretty relaxed after the situation. And I noticed in the one book I read, he was kind of more miffed about his shoe than the aircraft going down.
Yeah. Also, my mother said that later he there was a tradition to find the person who packed his shoe and thank them, and
Yeah.
he did that. And I don't know if that was after he came back to the States or what. I presume it was packed in the U.S. But so,
Yeah, no
and
one. I...
he was also, you can tell from his biography that he was fortunately or unfortunately, he was a risk taker. He always pushed the envelope.
Sure, and I bet that's a two-sided coin. You kind of needed those people to rally everybody else, but I can see that definitely being.
Well, following a bomber 100 miles out to sea, which we'll get to, and that kind of thing,
Right.
and then we'll get to his last fatal flight, and that was when it really came through. He was a risk taker and made some bad decisions on that one.
Yeah, and then throughout, so kind of some context here. So on December 8th, the Japanese attacked pretty much the entirety of Luzon all in the span of a day or two. And he was part of a desperate struggle, to be honest, with trying to maintain air superiority of the Philippines, which ended up not working out. You know, the Japanese really took over the air supremacy in a very, very big hurry, wiped out most of the 24th Pursuit Group's aircraft. And then he was eventually evacuated on a Beech-18 on January 1st, 1942, where the plan was for the pilots to head down to Australia to return with P-40s up through the islands, traveling through Java, and you know eventually to through Mindanao and then on to Luzon and to help bolster the remaining P-40s that were left. So that ended up not happening, right? So the Philippines fell in you know later in the or in early 1942. And the pilots that were sent down to Australia were diverted to the 17th Provisional Pursuit Squadron, eventually going to Java.
Yeah, let's take a minute to talk about that flight where they escaped. MacArthur gave the orders to get the pilots out if they could. Not all of them made it. Only a handful of the pilots were actually able to evacuate. The others had a tragically were captured by the Japanese, and some of them subjected to the Bataan Death March. But Bill Hennen got out with I don't know how many pilots they had. In that beach, what was the model? The
It
Beech
was a
eighteen.
Beech-18, yes.
Yeah, I did hear one story, and I don't know if this is just a, exaggeration. I know they had to put fuel drums inside the aircraft
Oh,
to make it.
yes.
They ended up flying in legs, something like 5,000 miles down to Australia, but I heard that they had to. I'll put a hose from the drums to the fuel tank, so they could refuel midair. Kind of the first primitive midair refueling,
Yes, and
from
it
within their own aircraft.
I was just reading about that just to refresh, and it's still after three or four times reading that, it's still odd to think, and we have it pretty easy now as pilots. So yeah, and then on Java, that's where he really found his combat success. So we'll kind of run through these in order, and Mike, feel free to fill in any context that you'd like. So we're kind of digging around, and using multiple sources here and found that his first victory came on February 3rd, 1942, which looks like it was a G3M Nell, which was a naval twin engine bomber that preceded the G4M Betty. And then, his second victory was also most likely a G3M Nell in February as well. And then his third and fourth victories were zeros on the 20th and 23rd of February of 42. And then his fifth victory was another zero on February 26, 1942, which made him an ace.
Now, you guys want to have more detail about the Java campaign? Are you guys going to talk about that, or do you want me to?
You go for it.
Well, it was a... Well, first off, going back to the Philippines, we were just really caught with our pants down in Southeast Asia. We just didn't have the planes, we didn't have the pilots, we didn't have much of anything. And that was certainly true in the Philippines. And then they went back to Java on a shoestring. They had, I don't remember how many planes, but not very many planes. They got back there and they operate out of a secret airfield. I think it was called Nagoro. Something like that. It was near Surabaya. And the Japs never found, I'm going to fall back into World War II jargon here, calling the Japanese the Japs, because that's what they did back then. They didn't find it until the final day. They were in Java for about a month. What was the Barch's book called? It was called Every Day a Nightmare.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Every day was a nightmare.
Right.
For those guys. But they had one, I think the highlight of his combat down there was when they took off to strafe and bomb Japanese landings at Palembang over on the big island of Java, whatever they call that island.
Over in Sumatra.
Yeah, right. They flew from the hidden air base over to Batavia, which is now Jakarta, and it was, talk about on a shoestring. They landed in Batavia. I don't know how many planes there were. I could look it up, but and they had to go into town and look for a hotel. I mean, we had no military support there at all, and so they landed there to refuel. And they had to go into the Hotel Des Indies, which I think is still around. And they had to they didn't want to give him a room there. And some British journalist overheard him. And he walked up to the desk and he said, you know, listen, mate, you're going to give these American pilots a room. And so they kicked some other people out of their rooms and they got rooms there for the night. And then the next morning they got up and off they went to Palembang and they bombed and strafed the Japanese there. And they came back. He was very low on fuel, and he just didn't want to break off combat. I mean, he claims in his diary that he really enjoyed combat, but that, you know, that I'm sure that didn't last. He came back on a wing and a prayer. He ran out of fuel as he was landing, and his cockpit had an inch of oil in the bottom of it. Wow. So that's how these guys fought there in Java. It was a hopeless case, but they in his diary, he also said it kind of proudly and sadly. He said, "We fought to the end." That's that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, for me, just putting it into context, when we were looking at just the geography of that region, you know, if these guys ran out of gas or they got shot down, and or at least got really badly damaged and they had to bail out, they were over, you know, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of miles, square miles of just jungle and water. And, you know, the odds of being recovered were slim to none. It's honestly, it was kind of terrifying to think, like, you know, would you rather ride out your plane and just say, hey, I'm not dealing with this, or, you know, take your chances of being, you know, found by maybe a tribe in the jungle that is allied with the United States, or with the allies, basically. Just, you know, really scary to think about, and, you know, taking what Mike just said into perspective.
And they're still finding planes today that haven't previously.
Or really? That,
yeah. Well, I don't know if you heard of Richard Bong. He's
no.
the ace of aces of the U.S. And it wasn't him. It was his plane, not him piloting it. But it went missing in New Guinea in 1944, I believe. And they just found it this year.
Wow.
80 years
As
later.
far as New Guinea's a horse of a different color.
Exactly.
That's really wild.
You just got to think about what's out there.
Oh, exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
But Bill Hannon mentioned in his diary several pilots who went down and were, in fact, rescued. Some went down in the water. They were able to fish them out of the water. And one of them landed within, I think he said, 300 yards of Japanese troops.
Wow.
Oh, my
and,
goodness.
Was able to escape. But they weren't also lucky. One of them got a machine gun in his parachute.
Yeah, that unfortunately was pretty common in those early campaigns and throughout the war. Yeah, so then do you want to tell us a little bit about how Bill chased out an aircraft 100 miles out to sea?
Well, you just told me, you said everything I know about it. He I guess the other guys broke off and he, you know, was enthusiastically chasing a bomber squadron out to sea and got the bomber.
Yeah, and it.
I think he got. Let's see, I can't remember which. The medals he received were, as kind of it's kind of hard to follow some of the. Was that in Java or was that later in Australia?
I believe that was in Java. Like you said, it was kind of hard to follow this time of the war. Everything was so erratic.
Yeah,
they're kind of relying off of, you know.
Well, he
his
was
diary.
awarded a Silver Star and a Distinguished Flying Cross with two oak leaf clusters and an air medal. And the Silver Star, I still can't quite figure out whether he's given that kind of as a for his general combat experience or for that experience, following that squadron of bombers out to sea.
Right. And we've kind of noticed that with other aces that we've covered is it's been kind of a varied decoration. It's been for general service and for individual combat. But yeah, we'll kind of segue in here. So as the Java campaign came to a close, everybody from that remained of the 17th Provisional ended up moving down to Australia with where they formed the 7th Pursuit Squadron of the 49th Fighter Group.
Yeah, one other thing on Java.
Yeah.
Is he wrote very darkly about the final days, and the people at the port of embarkation. It was just full of civilians trying to get out. You know, women, children, military, and it was just really dark. And his notes kind of turned dark towards the end of February as they were trying to get out. It's just, you know, they were screwed, and they knew it.
Exactly. And what really, it seemed like if you read that Every Day a Nightmare, Bill Barsh talks about at the end there, when the USS Langley, the very first aircraft carrier commissioned by the U.S. Navy, was actually turned into a tender, and it was ferrying just a bunch of P-40s. I don't remember how many, but enough to make a difference. And it was torpedoed and sank. And
really?
a lot of pilots also went down with it. There's a couple from North Dakota that went down with the ship. And that really sealed the deal.
Yep.
Because Java was meant to be a delaying action. You know, it was already kind of futile when they showed up. But, you know, they maybe could have stretched it out a little bit. It's a big what if.
Yep. Well, I think the Japanese wanted to invade Australia and they never got the chance.
Mm-hmm. No, and, you know, people like your father really started, you know, helping turn the tide. Australia, along with Midway, were kind of two zones where the U.S. started to assist, you know, the other allies in starting to push back. And that by then we were starting to see the ferry routes come into play through to Australia and start, you know, building up these bases. So Hendon was in Northern Australia, and there is nothing up there. Darwin, Bachelor Field, those type of areas were, I've seen in some notes that they're more primitive than Java. And even some of the Bataan airfields at the end of the Philippine campaigns. The flies were terrible, things like that. I've read a lot of other accounts where they just
were in Darwin.
In Darwin, yeah, everybody is just miserable.
Well, I'll tell you, he liked the girls.
Oh yeah, yeah, we gathered. I suppose not too much else in Darwin going on.
Well, they were all over Australia, you know, flying here.
That's true, Brisbane, and yeah. So, with the reorganization in Australia, it seems they reformed into the 49th Fighter Group, where Hennin was the 7th Pursuit flight leader in the 7th Pursuit Squadron, and we have an account here of his 6th victory, which was on April 24th, 1942, and I'm just quoting a book that that I have about the 49th Fighter Group. And it quotes, "The Warhawk Ace rapidly closed unseen within 200 yards dead astern. His accurate stream of 50 caliber tracers detonated the enemy's ship into a ball of fire, and aircraft number 36 was spattered by smoldering debris. The 7th Pursuit wingmen confirmed Hennin's 6th kill as they watched the flaming wreckage tumble into the sea."
It's a very detailed account.
It was good, yeah, yeah. And at this time, again, there's, you know, not many planes up there with you. You know, the tide is still very much in favor of the Japanese, and yeah, that was his 6th victory of 0.
Well, it says here, what, just less than a month or 2 months later, he downed a second 0 on June 15th, 1942. Do we have any
information on that? I could not find too much on that. I'm not sure if you found anything on that, Mike.
No, I don't have anything on that.
Yeah, and I just saw it in a victory record, pretty much.
Well, kind of getting into the markings that Hennin wore on his P-40, for those that are listening that might, you know, have a deep interest in monsters or mythical creatures, so to speak, you might recognize this. But on the rudder of Hennin's P-40, he had painted a bunyip. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And there's kind of a cool legend behind that, where it was a creature of the marshes in probably in that region, in Java. Yeah. Kind of based on the images that I've seen, resembles a dog. And it kind of goes that if you encountered a bunyip, I mean, you were in essence screwed, but if you managed to defeat it, you would basically inherit its great powers. And it was a very powerful creature. Something that, you know, I think Hennin really idolized and loved to adorn his aircraft. I was going to ask, Mike, was there any notes in his diary about his encounters, maybe not encounters, but, you know, how he applied or why he applied the bunyip to his tail?
No, nothing. He did a lot of hunting, so I'm assuming he got, you know, in touch with a lot of the Aboriginal people down there. By the way, I just looking on the June 15th victory. Let me quickly read you what he did say in his notes. He said, "Japs over again, and this time we hit them with both Burnett and Johnson, were shot down. Burnett is okay. I saw him bail out and locate his position on Quail Island. He was in the water for a few hours." It's amazing. "We made a quarter beam attack on the bombers, but no luck. Zeros got between me and one opened up on my tail, but out of range. One bobbed up in front of me and I filled him full of lead with a very long burst. A Zero crashed the same time Burnett's did and must have hit this one I shot. Anyway, I was given a victory."
Wow. Well, that just filled in that information. That's good.
Thank you.
Details on that one.
Yeah.
Awesome. By the way, there's another cute story that my mother told. He was being interviewed when he was back in the States by a newspaper reporter. And you know that we had kind of a stereotype with the Japanese, because Tojo wore thick glasses, and so the caricatures of the Japanese had them with buck teeth and thick glasses. And just to insult them. And somebody asked him, "Is it true that Japanese have poor vision?" And he said, "No, at all. They're perfectly capable of spotting me."
I believe it. You know, if you're, especially in the air, if you are constantly being attacked, I bet you think the enemy have the best eyesight you ever seen.
Exactly. And And it is kind of crazy. I mean, maybe that's just hindsight, but how the doctrine of the U.S. Army Air Force at the time was assuming that the Japanese had inferior planes and the pilots were inferior. And it has been, you know, call it what you will, but they did, you know, feed that prejudice, I guess, if you want to call it, into the pilots that the Japanese just didn't have good vision. And
yeah, well, it didn't take them long to figure that
and
one out.
And no, it didn't. Right. And yeah, well,
the other thing, I know you guys are aware of this, but it took me a while to figure out. He kept using the term. I dove out, and the Zeros were very maneuverable, light aircraft with very little armor, which is why they, once you got behind them, they were easy to knock down. The P-40 was very heavy. It was a flying brick, basically. And so when they got jumped by the Zeros, they could dive down at high speed. The Zeros couldn't keep up with them in a dive,
right,
and escape that way.
Yeah. Good insight. Kind of going back to the Bunyip real quick. Kind of cool. The 7th Pursuit Squadron adopted the nickname of the Screaming Demons, which still exists, at least for the 7th Fighter Squadron today, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and you can see it on F-22 Raptors nowadays. Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Neat.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool. That's pretty cool.
Absolutely. So Hennin became the 7th Fighter Squadron commanding officer in August of 1942, and then led the first echelon of the 7th to Port Moresby in New Guinea at the 14-mile strip. From here, Hennin returned stateside to eventually take command and train his own squadron in early 1943. Now, before we go on, which unfortunately leads us to the end of his life, we were kind of talking about squadrons that Hennin might have been, you know, in theory, if he had lived through the end of the war, other squadrons that Hennin might have taken command of. There was one that kind of piqued our interest. You know, this is all speculation, but I know Sam and I were talking about this during our notes session before we actually started the interview. Sam, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we saw through some of your notes that you sent us that he might have been commanding the 325th Fighter Squadron. Does that ring a bell?
No, I have absolutely no information about.
Okay,
I know he was preparing a squadron for deployment to Europe, I believe was the plan.
Yeah, and maybe I just skimmed through it, but the 325th Squadron is a pretty famous squadron. They were part of the 352nd Fighter Group, which is the 352nd. They're the blue nose. They call them the blue nose bastards of Botany. They're one of the highest scoring fighter groups of the war, especially in Europe. And another 7th Pursuit Squadron, 49th Fighter Group's member, which your father probably ran into, is George Preti. He scored 33.5, I believe, victories in Europe.
Highest scoring Mustang.
He is the highest scoring Mustang ace of the war. And there's a whole, I'll have to mail it to you, Mike, but there's a whole biography. There you go. Yep.
You know that book? You said you didn't have it.
I don't, but I remember you mentioning it.
Yeah, just for people who are listening, it's called the, hold on a second. Oh, the American Fighter Aces album. And it was, well, period. It's an excellent reference. It's got photos and bios on all the aces in World War II, World War I, I think Korea. So it's a good reference. It's got a few mistakes in it, but generally pretty good.
Yeah, well, appreciate that. And say we're going to pause the recording here. We kind of haven't, with this remote session here, we have to stop the meeting because it times out after 40 minutes. So what we'll do is we'll try again, if that works.
Sure.
And we'll do kind of a part two.
Okay.
And we're back. Sorry for the brief interruption. So, Mike, we were just on the conversation of Mike, or excuse me, a Bill returning back to the United States after getting out of the Pacific. Do you want to talk a little bit about what his return was like?
Well, he announced to anybody who would listen to him when he was overseas that when he got back, he intended to marry my mother, Elizabeth Hansaker, was her maiden name. And so he did. So he got back, and I think it was in January of 43 that they got married. And then he was on his way to his new assignment on Long Island at Farmingdale Field, which is now, I think, called Republic. It's still an air, it's still a airport. And he was training a squadron there and for eventual deployment to Europe. So that's what I wanted to say about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's kind of what we were going into just before the brief break was, you know, possible what, you know, what if scenarios. So on March 31st, 1943, Hennin took off from Long Island Airport in a North American BT-14 and was bound for Groton, Connecticut. And at some point during the flight, unfortunately, he went missing. And to this day, neither his plane or Hennin himself have been found. And I know, Mike, you've been researching this for almost, I'd assume, your entire life. Are there any leads as to what might have happened, where his aircraft might have went down, anything along those lines?
No, none whatsoever. But I have a few thoughts on the subject. First off, if you look at a map, flying from Farmingdale to Groton is mostly over land, because Groton is of course, on the other side of Long Island, but you can follow the coastline up until you're just drive across from Groton. And then it's a small hop over, what, maybe 20 miles, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't have my map in front of me. But so here's a very experienced pilot, a known risk taker, who, that's the other thing. They needed to send that aircraft over to Groton for maintenance. And I don't know what maintenance they needed on it, but they had taken the radio out of the plane for maintenance in Long Island. So here he was on a plane with no radio. The weather was kind of crappy. It was scuddy weather. That's what I heard anyway. And it was late March in New York. Now, this guy just got back from the South Pacific. So I kind of wondered if he didn't have icing, perhaps. It could be one thing that could have driven him down. It was a scud, so he may or may not have been able to see the ground to follow the coastline. So those are a couple of theories. But in any event, he obviously ended up in the water. They would have found him and his plane. And I have no idea whether he got out of the plane, and I don't know if he even had a life jacket with him. If he didn't, he wouldn't have lasted more than a few minutes. And that,
right.
Even with a life jacket, he wouldn't have lasted long in that water in March.
No.
It's too bad.
Yeah, BT-14, they're BT-14, for those of you listening, is pretty much a fixed gear version of the North American T-6 Texan, which is very famous trainer. And they don't really have anything in the way of icing protection. A lot of aircraft back then didn't, unless they were big burly bombers. So
Hennin's sister, Betty Jane Hennin, I think you said she was working down in Texas at the time as a nurse, or she...
Well, I don't know where she was at the time he was lost, but
okay,
she spent her career as a civilian employee of the Air Force.
Gotcha.
Okay. When I last saw her, she was in San Antonio working on she was a procurement agent for the Air Force. She was showing me around her project, which was some kind of a big building down there. But she was, of course, devastated, her only brother. And so she put up a marker at Fort Sam Houston National Cemetery, Military Cemetery, down there. So if you go to find my grave or something, find a grave, I think you'll find it there.
Absolutely. Well,
and then my mother, I was, she was, must have been a couple of months pregnant, and I was born in November, November 1st of 43. So do the math. March. So she wasn't very pregnant. I don't know if he even knew that I was on the way.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, Mike,
another of thousands of war stories that ended in tragedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, that it just, it happened so commonly back then. And, you know, we're thankful that you're here to tell us the story and to help keep your father's memory and his sacrifice alive.
Well, I'm thankful you guys are doing this project. As I said when you first contacted me, you're doing a lot of my work for me.
That's the name of the game for us.
Yeah, so. we enjoy it.
You forced me to finally get off my ass and complete the work that I've done already.
There you go.
Like I said, that's what we do best. So yeah. Now we're going to segue into our second part of the episode. In other episodes, what this means is now we will talk about the squadrons and groups that you know, the pilot was a part of. So, and that's basically going over the history from, you know, when it was first stood up through, you know, if it was either inactivated or if it's still around today.
Right.
So we'll get started here with the 17th Pursuit Squadron. So they were designated the 17th Squadron on March 14th, 1921. So one of those squadrons that, you know, was stood up after World War One, which is kind of, I think this might be one of our first.
It's kind of an opposite. So a lot of the aero squadrons in World War One, you know, there wasn't a need. You know, the U.S. was trying to go back to its isolationism, and they ended up, you know, putting up this squadron. I think it was kind of a conglomerate of other squadrons is what I was kind of gathering. And then throughout the 20s and 30s, it kind of, you know, changed hands a little bit, redesignated Pursuit Squadron in 1923. And then it was attached to the first Pursuit Group in 1936. So it was one of the very early squadrons here that kind of stood the test of time through to World War II, and was redesignated as the 17th Pursuit Squadron Interceptor on December 6, 1939. And then in 1940, late 1940 in December, it was assigned to the 4th Composite Group in the Philippines. And then in mid-1941, it was attached to the 24th Pursuit Group. So that was about the time as your father, Bill Hennin, ended up most likely going over to the Philippines when it was redesignated under that. And it was tasked with the defense of the Philippines, specifically Luzon and the Manila area, and was the majority of the time was based at Nichols Field. And then during the December 8th attack, the squadron was pretty much wiped out. You saw just most of the aircraft, you know, going out. And then eventually how it worked was the 17th Pursuit Squadron kind of went away. It was, you know, what pilots, we're going to put all these pilots into a group and have them fly solo missions or flying two or three aircraft at a time. So
it was kind of like, not to use an example from Hollywood, but it sounds like they were just kind of roamers, drifters.
Well,
if they saw targets of opportunity, they went for them.
Well, and within a week of the Japanese attacks, they were not allowed to intercept anymore. The P-40 was not a good interceptor. The Allison engine on board, it didn't have a supercharger. It basically topped out at 15,000 feet. And on top of that, they didn't have enough oxygen to go around. Mm-hmm. So your time above 10, 15,000 feet, your effective time for your consciousness just wasn't there.
Yeah.
And, you know, pilots would be flying up at those altitudes if they could get to those altitudes in time, feeling pretty sick.
Yeah.
So then pretty much the remnants of the 17th Pursuit Squadron that remained in the Philippines were pretty much flying reconnaissance missions and little harassment missions of, you know, landing barges, because the Japanese basically encompassed Luzon on all sides. And so they were attacking, you know, just these barges with troops in them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a drop in the bucket, but it was still, you know, showing the Japanese that there was still, you know, fight. Yeah. A fight.
Absolutely.
So then, you know, with Bill Hennen and many others, the squadron was reformed under the 17th Provisional Pursuit Squadron in Java. And that was in 1942. And then when Java was evacuated, the squadron then moved to Australia, where it was integrated into other groups. And the majority of the members, like Hennen, were integrated into the 49th Fighter Group among different squadrons.
Wow. I mean, for a squadron that, you know, was, because I assume they were in the Philippines for a good amount of both the pre-war years and...
Yeah, during... pretty much the year prior.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a lot of these Philippine vets actually ended up not making it too far into the war. You had big names like Buzz Wagner and Sprague, and, you know, just attrition got to it at the beginning of the war. Then the group that many of the members went to, the 49th Fighter Group, like Hennen, that had quite a long career in the war. And that group was formed on November 20th, 1940 at Selfridge Field in Michigan, and then moved to Morrison Field in May of 41, and actually trained on the Curtiss P-36s first. So the P-36s basically take a P-40 body and put a radial engine on it.
And, how did it perform and compare compared to like
the P-40? The U.S. didn't see much action with it. The only major time that you could see it was Pearl Harbor.
Oh,
a few were stationed on, gosh, I forget the field. I believe it was on Ford Island. And a few did actually see some combat. The Finns in the winter war, or sorry, in the subsequent war with the Soviets, they did pretty well with them. And the French used them quite extensively. But then the group was then sent over to Australia in January 40 of 1942 under the 5th Air Force at Darwin. And the idea of that force was to eventually work their way up to the Philippines, work their way through Java, and then eventually just hunker down in Australia as part of the preparation for a potential invasion by Japan. And the 7th Squadron, to which Hennen was attached to, was actually based at Bachelor Field specifically. And the group then moved to New Guinea, where Hennen was attached as the 7th Squadron CO to 14 mile strip at Port Moresby. So there was different strips at Port Moresby that were named different numbers. There was, for example, 7 mile, 10 mile, 14 mile. So it was just how far from Port Moresby it was. So that's how they were named. So I imagine that got pretty confusing to all the numbers over there, but, and then eventually the New Guinea campaign kind of came to a standstill, the Japanese invasion was halted there. They re-equipped with P-38s in September of 1944 and then took part in the reconquest for the Philippines. And then kind of as that was wrapping up towards the end of the war, they did move to Okinawa and then part of the occupation force in Japan in September.
So they were pretty busy during World War II is what I'm hearing.
Yes, yeah.
A lot of miles under their belt. For the guys or for listeners that are into the Korean War, the 49th went on to see quite a bit of action in the early days of the Korean War, initially covering the evacuation of civilian personnel from the southern tip of South Korea in 1950, and then later on supported UN ground forces with airstrikes, whether that was with F-51 Mustangs and then later F-84Es, excuse me. Now, for the more modern listeners, you might recognize the 49th Fighter Wing as the 49th Operations Group, who flew F-117A stealth bombers, well, technically bombers, even though in the F designation, and they were engaged in operations during Operation Allied Force in 1999, and then in Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. And they are still around today at, if I remember correctly, Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico, operating a very wide array of different aircraft underneath the 49th Operations Group. So a very fascinating history that can trace its lineage really to the darkest times in United States history. And they've been there, you know, holding the vanguard ever since. I think that's a really, really cool testament to, you know, obviously the group that he flew with and, you know, what they do today.
Right.
So with that, Mike, that kind of wraps up the episode. Is there anything you would like to add? Something for our listeners? Anything along those lines?
Well, I think that pretty much covers it. This has been, you guys sent me some really good book references that I have some of them and some of them I don't, and I'm going to get them. And so I think that concludes my part of this podcast.
Awesome.
All right. Well, we really appreciate your insight, Mike, and taking the time to chat with us over the last few weeks.
And... Well, you're very welcome. And as I said earlier, I really appreciate the work you guys are doing.
Thank you. I mean, sunny, coming from you.
From sunny North Dakota.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice and cold here right now.
Yep.
Yeah, no bad.
All right. Well, that wraps us up here. Thank you all for listening. And we know that it had taken a little bit, but we hope that today's episode makes up for it. I like I said at the beginning of the first part, I think this is a really special episode.
Yeah, and we wanted to do this right.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. And we'll see you on the next episode.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.